middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kiev is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, Surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kyiv with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kyiv is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians, and representatives of the resistance front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turning around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least 5 rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Ibrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a 3-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, she hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers. The United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Once again, the International Fajr Film Festival brought together filmmakers and movie critics from across the world, as well as movie lovers, this time for its 41st edition. A festival made even more special, considering that the international section was reintegrated into the national festival after 6 years of holding separate events.
This year, 26 feature-length movies from 25 countries were competing in the international section. For many of them, this is their regional premiere. The movie market also allows producers and filmmakers to get to know each other and negotiate further cooperation.
I've attended the festival on behalf of the Ministry of Culture of Russia, and based on what I've seen in the past 10 days, I believe that there is a great potential for joint production.
And for those keeping an eye on the festival, the award ceremony was what they'd been waiting for.
Jaishan Kalariar, the director of this movie.
Our jury made a slight change to the order. You'll know that it's initially for best director, but we decided that instead we would like very much to give it to a new and promising filmmaker who's both written and directed his film. So congratulations to him.
I would like to dedicate this award for the three filmmakers whom I admire, Mr. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Faradi and Majid Majidi.
I'm an engineer by profession, but when I got a lot of free time, I used to watch a lot of cinema. And when I watched Iranian films, they had a great influence in my style. And three filmmakers to be specific. Abbas Kiarostami, Asghar Farhadi and Majid Majidi have influenced my filmmaking style a lot. And my film is a byproduct of their films.
In the national section, 24 movies were picked out of 87 entries to compete for the top award. What made the national section stand out this year was a whole new generation of first-time directors from different provinces across the country.
Taking part in a festival is what motivates most of us working in the business, and I can tell you for sure that the competition was really tough this year with young up-and-coming directors who participated.
As far as I know, there were lots of young directors taking part this year, so I can tell you for sure that this wasn't an easy competition.
With all of its glitz and glamour and prestige, the 41st FAJ International Film Festival has come to an end, but this time promising new horizons for first-time directors. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Perhaps anticipating a hero's welcome, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky travelled to the Belgian capital on Thursday with a list of demands. He has asked for long-range missiles and warplanes to use against Russian forces. He also wants Kiev to be granted EU membership without delay.
Of course, membership, and that's why, of course, we need it this year. And this year, Charles, when I say this year, I mean this year.
Those with intimate knowledge of how the EU works believe it is a pipe dream.
Turkey will not be pleased because they are already waiting since 2005 in formal discussions. Then we have the Western Balkans. Also there, something is boiling in Bosnia and Serbia. So these countries, they will say, wait a minute, what about us? And for sure, there are definitely member states who will block this.
EU leaders concluded their latest summit on Friday. The most up-to-date cost of supporting Ukraine was revealed, and it's eye-watering.
67 billion of support we have mobilized in the last 12 months, from budget support to fast recovery, from energy supply to military capabilities, from humanitarian aid to refugee support, and we must do more.
A number of EU lawmakers encourage solidarity with Ukraine, but also want support for the bloc's own hard-pressed citizens.
Solidarity with our most vulnerable, who struggle to put food on the table or heat the home, or those in difficulty maintaining a roof over their heads.
While Zelensky was touring Europe, who was running the show back in Kiev? US and NATO commanders? The Kremlin has warned Western powers not to become too involved in the conflict. There's no doubt EU citizens have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for the people of Ukraine, but there's growing concern about the level of pressure, some might call it provocation, being exerted on Russia by Western leaders. Many are nervously asking, when might Putin say, enough is enough? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Economists have announced in their final estimate that the U.S. economy shrank for the second consecutive quarter in the 3 months ending in December. The latest figures released about the U.S. economy meet these experts' criteria for recession in technical terms, while rising inflation and rising bank interest rates have weighed on spending. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Experts believe that the United States is going to enter a rolling recession, meaning individual sectors decline in turn rather than all at once. despite U.S. officials' claim that unemployment being at its lowest point and gross domestic product or GDP rising 2.1% in 2022, inflation remains relatively high at 6.5%. Technology companies continue to lay off people by the thousands, and manufacturing is in a downturn. On top of that, the housing market is experiencing its worst sales slump since the Great Recession. While 69% of reporting companies missed analysts' expectations for the last quarter. During an appearance at a National Retail Federation event in January, Liz Ann Saunders, chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab, publicly stated that the economy will suffer from rolling recessions. Despite clear signs of a weak handover to 2023, some economists are cautiously optimistic the economy will skirt an outright recession. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell did little to calm investors in recent days, saying, "This cycle is different from other cycles. It just has confounded all sorts of attempts to predict." According to CNN, some economists believe that this perplexing economy points to signs of a rolling recession. Liz Ann Saunders said in January that during the COVID-19 pandemic, pockets of weakness were created in the economy in sectors such as housing and services, as everybody was locked down at home. Residential investment suffered its seventh straight quarterly decline, the longest such streak since the collapse of the housing bubble triggered the 2007-2009 Great Recession. There are signs the housing market is not in a good shape now. Mortgage rates have been trending lower as the U.S. Federal Reserve slows the pace of its interest rate hikes. Seung-Won Son, a finance and economics professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California, told the Reuters news agency, "A large portion of the reaction to higher interest rates is already in the economy and the financial markets. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve has succeeded in precipitating a rolling recession, it is time to think about an exit strategy." Inflation also subsided in the fourth quarter. A measure of inflation in the economy rose at a 3.2% rate, retreating from the third quarter's 4.8% pace of increase. Companies outside the technology industry, as well as interest rate-sensitive sectors like housing and finance, are hoarding workers after struggling to find labor during the pandemic. Yahoo said on Thursday it plans to lay off more than 20% of its total workforce as part of a major restructuring of its advertisement technology division. The company said the cuts will impact nearly 50% of Yahoo's advertising technology employees by the end of this year, including nearly 1,000 employees in the coming days. Yahoo, which is owned by private equity firm Apollo Global Management since a $5 billion buyout in 2021, claimed that the move would enable the company to narrow its focus and investment on its flagship and business called DSP, or Demand Side Platform. Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. A Gallup opinion poll showed recently half of Americans say their financial situation has worsened in comparison with the previous year, which is a record high since 2009. The pollster said, reflecting on their personal financial situations, 35% of the American public say they are better off now than they were a year ago, while 50% say they are worse off now compared to a year ago. It added, since 1976, when Gallup first asked this question, the share of Americans who expressed such concerns was higher only twice, during the Great Recession era in 2008-2009, and last year 41% of Americans said they're better off, and the same number of respondents expressed the opposite view. The estimate of personal financial situation is closely related to income. The opinion poll revealed that lower-income people more often feel they're losing ground. The survey read, most lower-income Americans, 61%, say their financial situation has deteriorated over the past year, while less than half that number, 26%, indicate that it has improved. Middle and upper-income Americans are also more likely to say they're worse off than better off, but by much narrower margins than seen among the lower-income group. Faced with high inflation and other concerns, almost two-thirds of Americans remain pessimistic about their financial prospects. 60% of the American public expect to be worse off a year from now, while 28% predict they will be better off. Also, a majority of Americans are largely pessimistic about national macroeconomic conditions. U.S. broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. A report says millions of Americans are facing a hunger cliff as more than 30 states plan to phase out emergency food stamp benefits next month. According to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the cuts, which will take effect in March, will impact more than 30 million people who are enrolled in the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, across 32 states. Ellen Wollinger, director for SNAP, or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, at the Food Research and Action Center said, "This hunger cliff is coming to the vast majority of states, and people will on average lose about $82 of SNAP benefits a month. This is a stunning number." She added, "That means a family of four could see their monthly benefit cut by about $328 a month. The worst hit could be elderly Americans who receive the minimum monthly benefit." According to Ellen Wollinger, the SNAP payments would fall from $281 to as little as $23 per month. Beginning in March of 2020, SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, was expanded to allow households to receive the maximum benefit instead of income testing and allocating aid based on how much they earned. Some 18 states had already ended their emergency allotments. The remaining 32 states that have continued their additional aid are losing that extra money in March due to a provision in the 2023 Omnibus Spending Bill signed into law in December that directs the emergency allotments to end next month. California and Texas, with 5.1 million and 3.6 million recipients respectively, are among states that are facing imminent reductions in food benefits. And New Mexico is home to the highest number of SNAP beneficiaries per capita, with more than 3 in 10 households in New Mexico currently receiving augmented food benefits. Deputy Director for SNAP at FRAC, Gina Platanino, told CBS News, "You're going to see, as the months go along, more families being hungry, more people visiting food banks, and just seeing the terrible effects that this had on all of these people." Analysts have warned that many Americans continue to struggle with food insecurity. They say with food stamp cuts being signed into law in December, neither states nor individuals have had much time to prepare.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The first state visit by an Iranian president to China in more than 20 years, greeted by the Chinese President Xi Jinping on a red carpet, an extraordinary display of camaraderie between the presidents of the two countries. So why should the U.S. be worried? Or does it even matter? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this relationship, what it means in the context of the New World Order, and how this bond will, at a minimum, prove futile, the effectiveness of the U.S. sanctions. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chung-Yang Institute for Financial Studies, joins us from London. From Montreal, we have Arnold August, author and journalist, joining us. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, John Ross, taking a look at the visit by Iranian President to China. Obviously, it's a high-profile visit. As I mentioned, it's the first visit in 20 years. And we're looking at not only the fact that they're going to solidify ties even further, no new news there, but they're going to use in a major way the 25-year cooperation agreements as the platform to expand their ties. Can you first, before we even get into that, tell us why Iran is actually important to China?
The economies of China and Iran, well, let's look at the economy, we'll do the politics in a minute, right, are highly complementary. China is the most important manufacturing center in the world, the world's workshop, as it's put it, and Iran is one of the most important suppliers of energy in the world, as well as other things. This makes them highly complementary. Then there are also political reasons, of course, because China is the biggest country in East Asia, and Iran is a very crucial part of what's called the Middle East, or we might call it West Asia. And then there are a whole series of important countries which they both have ties with as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. China has relations, and Iran has relations with Russia, Pakistan, India, and other countries. So therefore, the economic foundation is extremely solid. That's why you can have a 25-year basis. And they also have important political interests. So it's very logical that the two want to cooperate.
Taking a look at that 25-year comprehensive agreement, which is one of the major platforms in order to expand the relationship with Arnold August, I guess you can call them rough estimates, about $400 billion when the deal was first announced. How is it that the length of time versus the dollar figure, but more important would be the length of time? How does that constitute the relationship between these two countries when it comes to the geopolitics of the world vis-a-vis the U.S.? Because Iran is fitting with China into the new world order, in a matter of speaking.
Yes, I think that's very significant. Just to add to what John said regarding the economic and political repercussions or reasons to see the importance, historic importance, in my view, of this new Iran-China relationship, I would add the following. Given the, very furious racist attacks against the peoples of the East, such as against China and Iran, and even though Russia is not entirely in Asia, but partly so, it is very significant as a pushback against that, that the two most important civilizations in Asia, that is China and Iran, are getting together to organize a long-term 25-year cooperation deal. This is very significant, and it will help the resistance to all of the racist innuendos and open attacks against the people of Asia. And of course, the fact that they can have it 25 years indicates very clearly that the both countries are solidly in control, the leadership and the people are solidly in control of their sovereignty and in favor of how the development, economic and political development is going on, so that they can assure a 25-year agreement. I was just talking about 25-year agreement. Recently, as we discussed before, Iran and Venezuela also signed an important 25-year agreement. So this, you know, scenario of long-term agreements is very important. It shows the confidence in these countries that are opposing U.S. hegemony. And yes, you are right. The United States does have something to fear for this growing momentum to oppose U.S. hegemony.
Well, that's what I want to ask you, what that fear should be, John Ross, when you have the Chinese President Xi Jinping say things like, quote, no matter how the international and regional situation changes, China will unswervingly develop friendly cooperation with Iran, or things like opposes external forces interfering in Iran's internal affairs or undermining Iran's security and stability. First of all, this, I'm guessing, would be in a direct reference to the U.S., but what does the U.S. have to fear here?
Well, I'm sure that it applies to any country which carries out interference of the type which has been condemned, but the United States is the main country that's doing it, so doubtless it refers to the United States in particular, but it would be equal applied to any other country that wanted to interfere in that way. What the United States has to fear is not the fact that people are against the United States. No country in its right mind goes out of its way to pick a fight with the United States. The United States remains a very powerful country. Most countries in the world like to have good relationships with the United States, but the problem is that the United States acts against the interests of other countries. This is absolutely clear, both some cases is directly. For example, the tariffs against China, the sanctions against Iran, the sanctions against Cuba, sanctions against Venezuela. There's very direct attacks, but there are also indirect attacks. For example, the United States is attempting to cut Huawei out of Europe's telecommunications system. What does this mean? It means that everybody in Europe is going to have to pay more for their telecommunications, and therefore this is adverse for the economies in Europe. So this is an indirect attack on European countries. Or indeed, that Europe has been plunged into chaos by US policy. The expansion of NATO eastward, which is what really behind the Ukraine war, has created a situation when Europe now, we've got the highest inflation for 40 years. We've got a big war going on. Contrast that to the situation in Asia. In Asia, you've got developing countries of Asia, you've got every political regime that you can possibly think of, I would think. I mean, you've got socialist countries in Vietnam and China. You've got a monarchy in Thailand. You've got various types of republics. But the one thing that they're determined to do is that they want to pursue their own path of development. They're not going to be blocked from that by the United States. So it's not that countries are attempting to attack the United States, it's that the United States is attempting to attack other countries. The difference is now that many, many countries are not prepared to go along with this. I mean, we can see, for example, on the sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine war, the countries that represent 85% of the world's population have refused to go along with the US sanctions. It's the US, which is isolated in itself because it insists upon attacking other people. They don't want to attack the United States, but they will defend themselves if they are attacked.
Well, the way that this trip is being reported, it's not that favorable, Arnold August. Some of the headlines, for example, or the way it's being reported, saying both countries, China and Iran, are facing pressure from Western nations over their positions on Russia's military operation on Ukraine. I mean, the type of pressure that they're talking about, isn't that the type of pressure that the U.S. actually and the U.S.-led NATO placed on Russia in the first place for 7 years when they were getting closer to Russia's borders? You know what I mean? I mean, yes. They're trying to take that importance away from the union of these two countries. Why is it that the importance of this relationship is being dragged to a lower level when it's of significance in the way that it really is when you take a look at the potentialities between the two?
Well, regarding what you say, the United States wants to pressure Iran and China to, abandon their position with regards to Ukraine and instead support indirectly the American NATO narrative and military actions in Ukraine. Well, good luck. It won't happen. It hasn't happened up to now, despite everything, and it won't happen in the future. Now, yes, U.S. is the main culprit, and they are being singled out. But as the way things are going in Eastern Europe, for example, it's not going very well for the United States. While they're trying to force China and Iran to follow the United States, in the United States, it was just announced yesterday that Netherlands and Denmark refuse the U.S. German proposal to send tanks into Ukraine. So the alliance in NATO is very weak compared to the growing alliance, solid principled alliance between China and Iran and other such entities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
When you take a look at a particular quote from the Iranian president, John Ross, of which he said, and this concerns sanctions, he said the continuation of sanctions will seriously undermine world peace. That's quite a statement. What are we looking at when it comes to the issue of sanctions and how countries like Iran and China or Russia and China and other countries who are moving away from the U.S. when it comes to the reach of the U.S. sanctions, that this would pose somewhat of a threat for the dominance of the U.S. dollar, which obviously affects the U.S. economy once the dollar is threatened?
Well, yes, I mean, the fundamental, I agree very much with this statement, this is a threat to world peace. The reality is that the United States is losing in peaceful economic competition. That this is the fundamental problem. It goes on a lot about how greatly productive its economy is and how great it is. But the reality, the facts show that the U.S. is losing. Okay, let's look at during the imposition of the tariffs by the United States against China happened to be a little bit before, but basically overlapped with the period of the pandemic. Okay, we can make a balance sheet of what happened during the pandemic, which is that China's economy grew 2.5 times as fast as the United States during the 3 years of the pandemic. China's continued to develop its international trade, and it hasn't even been forced to cut its exports to the United States. I mean, this is a comprehensive economic defeat that the United States has suffered on the economic field. It also expected, in regard to Iran, that Iran would collapse, et cetera, just as it believed that with the sanctions against Russia, Russia would collapse. None of this has happened. The danger in the situation is that the United States, although it's losing in peaceful economic competition, is still the world's most powerful military machine. And therefore, the danger is that it will increasingly resort to military means. This is why it is indeed a threat to peace. The Ukraine war is a new threshold. The United States has carried out attacks on developing countries before, Serbia, Libya, Iraq. this is the first time it's prepared to basically provoke a war with a nuclear armed power, Russia. So this is a very dangerous situation from the point of view of peace. And I entirely agree with this. The US is caught in an infernal logic. Because it can't sort out its own economic problems, it resorts more and more first to sanctions and then also to cold wars. And now we see it's more resorting to hot wars as well. And this is very dangerous.
Another focus of the two countries' ties is something that is probably one of the biggest projects that is being executed in the world, and that is the Belt and Road Initiative here, Arnold August, which, enough can't be said about it because it's so vast and so big. This is something that obviously Iran is a part of because of the route that it takes both via land and also via the sea. It's a project that's obviously in developing as we speak. Now, what's interesting about this, first of all, your reaction to that, but what's interesting about this is the fact that you had the U.S. through the G7 make an announcement last year, was it, that they were going to launch one to counter China, and their first announcement was $600 billion. But then there's silence. Nothing said about that countering that they want to do. Tell us what you think also about that, why it is that the U.S. and its G7 partners thought that they could counter China in this huge project.
Well, I think it has to be spelled out a bit that the Belt and Road Initiative is really, historically a momentous breakthrough in terms of expanding a trade and cooperation, political ties between countries of different political system over a very vast territory of land. And, for the United States to even think, even to put it on the agenda, as you said, they did during the G7, to have the equivalent of the Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, nothing has come out of it. It's impossible for them to do so. So the Belt and Road Initiative is also tied to other important political and trading blocs, such as BRICS, which includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and more countries are asking to be included, such as Argentina and Iran, I believe. So all of these different conglomerations or coalitions, economic and political, are building up. But the main thing I would like to emphasize today, if I may, that China, which has been so much denigrated by the Western powers, United States and others over the centuries, has now turned history on its head. And rightfully so, it's poetic justice that China is at the head, leading this worldwide movement, it is a worldwide movement against U.S. hegemony, to develop a multipolar world where countries of different political orientations, economic levels, etc., can collaborate amongst themselves despite U.S. hegemony. I think that what is happening now, there was a very interesting a title of a Global Times article today from China regarding the meeting between Chinese and Iranian leaders in Beijing today. It said, "China-Iran, no need to watch attitude of U.S." In other words, we've been talking about decoupling. Before it was Russia, now China, whole sections of the world are decoupling from the United States and Europe. Not because they want to do so. They were forced to do so as a result of the NATO-U.S. aggression against Russia. So now, as the Global Times says from China today, we're past that. We are decoupling. We don't even care what you say about the growing Iran-Chinese relationship. And I think this type of thinking going against U.S. hegemony is very, very significant.
All right, we need to expand a little bit more on this with you, John Ross, when it comes to the Belt and Road Initiative. I'm taking a look at some of the vast landmass that this covers. It starts out in China, and then it goes through countries like you got Almaty. I'm talking about the cities now, Almaty, Bishkek, Obviously, Dushanbe, Tehran, obviously, there also, Istanbul in Turkey, Moscow, and it goes all the way to Rotterdam in Germany. This is the land route that we're looking at. On the bottom, I'm looking at the water route where countries like India is there, you've got Africa there. And basically, my question to you is, when you have a project of this size, of which Iran is part of that, and due to Iran's geographic location, obviously it makes it an ideal country to be part of this project, doesn't this mean that these countries then, that China will gain somewhat of a political clout because of their co-op on this huge project? Because loans are given out, and therefore these countries then would be doubtful that they would go against China unless something really incredible happens. And that obviously is something, again, that perhaps is not to U.S. liking.
Well, I don't think it's correct, because the development of any country primarily depends upon its internal situation. So undoubtedly, the capital investments carried out by China are very useful, and they aid countries, and it's a win-win. So therefore, that's good. But they're not enough to determine the economic situation in a country. If the country is developing in a favorable way with a good economic policy, China's investment is very useful. If, on the contrary, a country is pursuing a greatly misguided economic policy, then Chinese investment won't make the difference. But what's the good about the present time is you have a development in the world taken in many countries, with countries which are want to develop themselves. If we look at the so-called Global South, that is the developing countries, this is just increasing its percentage of the world economy, and in real terms, purchasing power parity terms, is already larger than the developed countries. And they want to get on with it. Again, it's not even just in the situation in Asia. I mean, I thought that President Lula, re-elected, has put it recently, he put it very well. He says, Brazil is at war with poverty. It's not at war with Russia. And I think he means by that it's not at war with Iran or China or anybody else. It wants to develop itself. And there's an increase in number of countries. This is why we can see very clearly, on the sanctions against Russia, as I say, 85 countries, which have 85% of the world's population, refuse to go along with this, despite the pressure of the United States. They've even got some got somewhat different views on the conflict in the Ukraine. What they're not prepared to do is to subordinate their national development to the interests of other outside forces. And of course, this is what the United States finds it difficult to accept, because it thinks that it should run, despite the fact it's about 5% of the world's population, it thinks it should be able to tell the other 95% what to do. And the other 95% are increasingly saying, no, we'll get on with our own business. I agree what was said. Iran and China don't have to work out what the United States thinks about this. They just have to get on with good, mutually beneficial relations. And the same applies to Brazil. The same applies to many other countries in Asia.
All right. 30 seconds to you, Arnold August, in closing.